You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Now that we're a few days out from the results of the election, it is time to do what we do best, what I talked about at the top of the show, dig into policy. And to be clear, there's a lot we don't know yet, but there are things that we do. So to start off our discussion of Donald Trump's presidency, we bring in our own Washington Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
So you have been saying really this entire election season that this is about insiders versus outsiders. And you know, if we think about this election, there's certainly a strong argument to be made that the results bore that out. What is your post-election take on this insider-outsider dynamic?
I think that Donald Trump won in large part because he tapped into this deep feeling of loss or potential loss of standing in the economy and in our culture in general, but definitely in the economy among people who live in former industrial states of the United States, basically what we call the Rust Belt. But it's more than that. It's more than just Trump appealing to those people. The Democratic Party also lost this election because it didn't. The Democratic Party had the chance to appeal to those people. And I think as much as Donald Trump won because he appealed to disaffected Americans, economically disaffected especially, Hillary Clinton lost because she didn't appeal to those same people.
And we can't ignore race in this. Even if you look at the income breakdown brackets, it certainly breaks down by race.
That is absolutely true. You can't talk about who voted for whom without looking at that, because while it's absolutely not true, of course, that all white people voted for Trump, it is true the other way around, that almost all of the people who voted for Trump were white or are white. And so, and what is striking about that, I mean, it's very common for a presidential candidate to appeal to certain groups of people. Usually it's a cross-section of race, class, you know, location, that sort of thing. In this case, the people who voted for Trump spanned across educational and economic divides. People who made less than $20,000 a year, people who made more than $200,000, people who have haven't finished high school, people who have PhDs. The electorate that voted for Trump, the demographics there are striking because the one thing that brings them together is their race.
I want to shift to governing, because governing in many ways and putting together a transition team, a cabinet, all of those things, that's an insidery move. So
yeah,
let's say you are Donald Trump and you don't have the cabinet in waiting that I think a lot of folks thought the Clinton campaign has. How do you do that? Does that mean you do tap old party hands? You do tap lobbyists? And if you do that, how do you not alienate all the people who voted for you?
The thing is, Lizzie, I can't say strong enough how different this election and this incoming administration is from the way Washington has worked for decades, if not a century. I mean, I have never seen, no one has seen in a century, a presidential candidate less affiliated with his own party or his stated party, less beholden to that party, with fewer ties to the lobbyists and thinkers of that party. And so a lot of those people kind of eschewed his candidacy in the first place. We don't know who's going to want to work for him and who he's going to want to work for him.
So let's talk about some of his promises. Let's play our first clip, which focuses on trade and jobs.
I'll bring back our jobs from China, from Mexico, from Japan, from so many places. I'll bring back our jobs and I'll bring back our money.
Okay, Andrea. Can that happen?
Well, no. I mean, you know, if what he means is that we're going to bring back the jobs that went to those places, it is unlikely to the point of impossible that those jobs will come back. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One, you know, manufacturing has changed drastically. If those jobs, if the manufacturing processes that used to be here, say textile, steel, pick an industry that used to be here, were to come back, They would not be performed by people. There would be a decimation of the number of jobs in those industries in the first place. They already are. If what he is saying is that we will bring jobs, not bring back those jobs, but bring jobs, well, then there are a lot of opportunities for that. But it takes a kind of commitment to social policy that we haven't necessarily seen. You can lay down tariffs on other countries importing things here and hope that that means that American businesses will recreate industry here. But like I said, that doesn't necessarily create jobs, and it's likely to start a trade war. You know, it is much more likely that what we will see if the incoming Trump administration really gets serious about creating jobs for people is, you know, a much higher commitment to retraining, to sort of, you know, figuring out what there is now and how people can get into those jobs. You just can't go back 50 years.
Essentially, all of our recent presidents have increased executive power. We have heard a lot from the president-elect about executive orders. I want to play that clip.
We're going to eliminate every unconstitutional executive order and restore the rule of law to our land.
I'm curious how that plays out once he assumes the presidency. What do you think we can expect to see on that front?
Well, I think there are a few things you can count on Trump vacating as soon as he comes in. Climate change agreements, you know, on EPA regulations. Some trade executive orders are available for that. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP negotiations. There are some healthcare orders that support Obamacare that aren't actually in the legislation that he can repeal immediately. Deferred action for what President Obama calls, you know, the dreamers. These are the children of undocumented immigrants who are themselves undocumented, who get deferred action on their immigration status. I mean, these are things that you can pretty much count on Donald Trump at least taking a very critical eye to, if not completely vacating the moment he gets in. But let's talk about the root cause here. The reason that so much is done these days by the executive branch, both in executive orders and, frankly, regulations coming from executive branch agencies, is because the Congress itself has been deadlocked, with a few small exceptions, for, you know, a couple of decades. And whenever you have like a vacuum of power like that, where, you know, people can't respond, Congress can't respond out of deadlock to something facing the United States, then the executive branch is able to come in and put in an executive order that, because of the deadlock, Congress can't either supplant or, you know, figure out a way around. The thing that's interesting to me with Donald Trump coming in and vacating a lot of executive orders is that he will also have, ostensibly, a stronger Congress, because Republicans are in control of both the House and the Senate. And with a Republican president, that could change things.
Does that mean, since Congress controls the purse strings, that they are likely to fund some other parts of his agenda, a wall, say, on the border with Mexico, or significant infrastructure spending?
I think infrastructure is a place where we can expect to see real movement. And Donald Trump is coming in at the same time saying, we're going to stimulate, you know, the economy with all of this infrastructure, create new jobs and everything, but also we're going to cut taxes. And the problem he's going to have is that the moment you say my priority is to cut corporate taxes and the middle class income tax and so on and so forth, you start draining the treasury of your ability to actually invest in those things. So, you know, the great horse trade will begin and has already begun, I promise you.
Andrea Seabrook, our Washington Bureau Chief, thank you so much.
It is a pleasure, Lizzie.